Every year, the Writers' Symposium by the Sea, sponsored by Point Loma Nazarene College, brings an eclectic mix of celebrated authors to San Diego. And it's our pleasure to welcome one of those authors to Midday Edition, my guest, Chris Hedges. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, formerly a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, and presently a popular online journalist. His column published on the TruthDig website was awarded Best Online Column in 2010. Chris Hedges is also a prolific political writer, author of 9 books, including the most recent compilation of his online articles called The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. Chris Hedges, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, your column this week on TruthDig was about the future of the Occupy movement. In fact, you've written a great deal about the Occupy movement. Why is that?
Well, I have, in the last few books, come to the conclusion that the political system doesn't work, at least for ordinary working men and women, that we've undergone a kind of corporate coup d'etat in slow motion, and that the only mechanisms we have left to challenge formal structures of power are acts of civil disobedience. And I have carried out acts of civil disobedience with Veterans for Peace and other groups even before the rise of Occupy. But Occupy articulated something that I thought was extremely important and in a way that I could embrace. In the last few weeks, I've been battling the black bloc anarchists. I call them in a column the cancer of the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. These are the groups that get their name because they move in a group in en masse, dressed in black, cover their faces, carry out acts of petty vandalism, taunt the police, and I think this is deeply destructive to this movement, because I think the power of the Occupy movement is that it really did resonate with the 99%, that it articulated something that not only the poor, the working class, but even the middle class is experiencing, and that is our reconfiguration into a kind of neo-feudal society where you have a rapacious oligarchic elite. I mean, the head of Walmart makes $11,000 an hour. And then you have people struggling on $7.25 an hour, working 2 and 3 jobs, being pushed out of their homes, 6 million people losing their homes. But I think it has to remain nonviolent if it is going to bring in, as it has done, the mainstream. And this article on Monday comes from a conversation with Ralph Nader.
Right. About the minimum wage that you just referenced.
Yes. And Nader, and I think correctly, thinks that the movement can build broad popular support. Of course, the unions would get behind it. The California Nurses Association, which has been one of the most courageous and vocal unions in the country on this issue, La Raza, the NAACP. I mean, and of course, it's just a matter of fairness, because it's not been indexed. In real terms, those living on minimum wage or close to minimum wage have seen their salaries stagnate or decline. I think it has a potential to resonate across the country. And we know from opinion polls roughly 70% of Americans support raising the minimum wage to about $10 an hour.
A lot of political movement, even in the middle class and the working class in this country, though, has been fueled by people who frame the argument and pit people against each other. For instance, we just had a talk about pension reform in San Diego County, and the argument could be made that the idea of saying public sector workers should not get guaranteed pensions anymore is pitting public sector workers against private sector workers who basically have no retirement pension plans anymore. And yet, it's a very popular argument. People say, yes, why should I be working for someone who doesn't, who gets a pension? Why should I be paying that pension for that person?
It's an insidious argument, and it's asking the wrong question. The question is, what happened to our society? Why aren't people in the private sector, as they once did, as steelworkers did, and I come out of the working class, you know, relatives who could make $50 an hour, who had medical benefits, who had pensions, who could on that salary. None of them got rich, of course, but they could support a family, send their kids to college, buy a small house. What happened to that? That's the question. And by these corporate systems of information have reframed it in the same way that before the rise of the Occupy movement, we talked about a deficit crisis. They frame the language by which we discuss it. We don't have a deficit crisis. We have a revenue crisis. And much of our revenue crisis comes from the fact that large corporations don't pay taxes. General Electric, Bank of America, they don't pay an income tax. They haven't for years. And these unbelievable bonus packages and CEO salaries in the tens and hundreds of millions of dollars, it's utterly obscene. And I think that as we have seen a consolidation of the media into the hands of roughly six corporations, Viacom, General Electric, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Disney, as Dorothy Parker used to say about Katharine Hepburn's emotional range of acting, the discussion ranges goes from A to B. And that's the problem, we're not asking the right question. So the last readout of unionized labor in this country is largely public sector.
You, in your writings and in some of the speeches that I've heard you give on YouTube, are very critical of President Obama. You say many people who voted for him are deeply disappointed. Can you explain that?
Well, I didn't support Obama, and I think it's because a close examination of the systems of power illustrate, as probably our greatest living political philosopher Sheldon Wolin has pointed out, that we exist under a system that's best described as inverted totalitarianism. And by that, he doesn't mean classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. That in classical totalitarian regimes, you have a reactionary or a revolutionary party overthrowing a structure and replacing it. In inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet internally have seized all of the levers of power as to render the citizen impotent. And we see that in one piece of legislation after another, all of which are written by corporate lobbyists, Obamacare being a good way to start. This is just the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the pharmaceutical and insurance industry, $400 billion in subsidies. One of the first things the White House did after the passage of the bill was hand out exemptions, because these insurance companies do not want to care for chronically ill children. I mean, I come out of seminary. Think of it in moral terms. We live in a nation where it is now legally permissible for corporations to hold sick children hostage while their parents frantically bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. And Obama is as craven to these interests as was George W. Bush. I mean, he has broken just about every campaign promise he made, including, by the way, the promise to raise the minimum wage to $9.50 by 2011. He has now using super PACs, which he said he would never do, to fund his campaign. He has done nothing to restrain the criminal activity of the speculator class on Wall Street. And in the 17th century, financial speculation was a crime. Speculators were hung. And today they control, they dominate our economy, and they run our political space. And I think that the Democratic Party is as broken as the Republican Party.
So where is one to go politically?
To act, to occupy, to civil disobedience. And I think that's the only way to put pressure on the centers of power. But the question is whether they get the numbers. If you continue to have incidents, as we saw in Oakland, where you have these hooligans dressed in black, breaking coffee shop windows and desecrating public property and burning flags, well, then we're finished. And, you know, frankly, just as the state has employed tremendous resources externally to remove these Occupy encampments, I have no doubt that they are working internally to destroy them. And for me, violence and vandalism, disrespect, is the fastest way to alienate the Occupy movement from the mainstream, and I've got to believe that's what they want to do.
I'm going to ask you a question that's really a 180 from what we've been talking about. You were for many years a war correspondent, and I wonder if you could talk about your reaction to the news of the deaths of three journalists in Syria that happened over the last 2 weeks.
Well, I knew Marie Colvin, of course, very well. We'd worked together in the Middle East. We were colleagues, not friends, but nevertheless, I was a little surprised at how much her death affected me. I have, over the 20 years I was a war correspondent, lost many, many people I worked with, some of whom I was very close to. I think my reaction was one where I found the mythologizing of what they do repugnant. There are very dark motives that drive us into these situations. I do believe that they, in the end, serve a vital and important role in terms of chronicling what happens. But I think also there's a tendency to use war to endow themselves with glamour. They're adrenaline junkies.
Is that what happened to you?
Yes, I speak. I know of what I speak.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so it was a mixed bag of emotions when you heard about
that. Well, of course, I was deeply saddened and troubled by her death and her loss. Also the way she died. I mean, I've been in buildings that I'm hit by, you know, it was hit by a rocket and they were running down the stairs and they were 10 feet from the door and was hit by another rocket and they were killed. I mean, the situation is just so close to situations I've been in. So on the one hand, yeah, I mean, it was quite devastating, her death. On the other hand, the kind of very one-dimensional portrayal of war correspondence, which was something that I worked very hard to counter in War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, was mythic rather than real.
What are you going to be speaking about tonight at the Writers' Symposium?
Well, I think I'm supposed to speak about all my books. I don't know how they're – I guess we'll have to extend it well past midnight. But I think, you know, they've picked out topics from several – and actually the themes are there. I mean, you know, it's – I grew up in the church. I come out of the seminary. You can't escape your upbringing. I mean, life's a circle.
You can't turn on the news without hearing about something like that today.
Well, you just – also – you just look at the world in mm-hmm. a different way. I think when you're raised in those kinds of environments – you have a different vocabulary, a different language, and I think ultimately sometimes you ask different existential questions. And I think those questions, although my books are on a range of topics, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning is a meditation on war and the poison of war and what it does to individuals and societies. The latest book is very different.
I want to thank you, Chris Hedges, and I want to tell everyone that you will be at the Writers' Symposium by the Sea tonight at 7 at Point Loma Nazarene University. For more information about attending that event, you can go to our website, kpbs.org/midday. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.